Welcome to the Weekly Squeak, your weekly geeky squeak with me, Christian Chiller. You can find more about the show at christianchiller.com/podcasts. In fact, that page has had a little makeover. You can now listen to all the previous episodes straight from the page as well. And you can also find other ways to listen to the show on the same page. The Enthusiastic Amateur podcast, I'm still waiting for interviewees to get back from holiday to approve shows so we can release it. I have two episodes ready to release, but it was a very collaborative experience, so I want to make sure everyone's happy with it, so I have to wait a little bit longer. But I do have something else I have been working on that I will tell you about a little bit later in the show. We're going to have a handful of links, and then I have an interview with Jean-Georges Perrin. I'm pronouncing it the French way because he is actually originally French, although he now lives in the USA. He is the first non-US citizen to be nominated, well, and elected as an IBM champion, which is a program for people who are highly recognized in the IBM community. But we will be speaking specifically about a book he is working on from a publisher that I actually have done some work with as well, Manning Publications. And this is a new book, Spark in Action. This is Apache Spark, an analytics engine for big data. Not Adobe Spark, in case you wondered. In any case, you want to know whether the interview will be relevant to you or not. But yeah, this is Apache Spark. So if you're into big data and analytics, then this will be a very interesting interview for you. And if you stay tuned, we'll also have some discount codes for that forthcoming book. So stay around after the links. But first, yes, some links. I just have three links for you today. The first one is an old link from 2014. From the New York Times Magazine, written by Laura Hudson on Twine. I have been experimenting a lot with creating some games, and more of that later, actually. That's going to be related to my little announcement later in the show. And Twine is an engine, a platform, a language, a tool, whatever you want to call it, for creating interactive fiction, which is kind of the games that I am most happy with right now. I covered this a little bit in the last show as well with a history of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy game, but that was using a very custom system that probably Twine can now do very easily, and it runs in a browser, of course. That's the modern world for you. Twine is a tool anybody can use to create games. Whether they count as games is a controversial topic, which the article covers in some detail. Some people just describe them like clicking through a book, kind of like the Choose Your Own Adventures. And they are to a certain degree, but if you're into storytelling and kind of very simple but effective in terms of narrative gameplay, then Twine is a very interesting tool. And I have been experimenting with it. I haven't released anything in Twine yet. I've actually been using a different system that's specifically aimed at a particular game called Expedition, which has its own little engine, but they're all sort of comparable. And it appeals to me because I'm more of a storyteller. I'm not so good with mechanics, but I have lots of ideas for stories. So this is it's a tool that appeals to me. And it's a tool that appeals to a lot of gamers, people who have ideas but are not so good at coding or design or don't have the money or other resources for this. The interesting thing about this post is also, if you bear in mind, it's from 2014, ties into the Gamergate scandal. And actually the key protagonist of the piece is one of the main victims of the Gamergate scandal. And the game was Depression Quest, which was created in Twine. And I guess some of the arguments of some of the people involved were that it's not really a game. I mean, that what is art? What is a game? This is an interesting discussion. I actually have a board game based on a computer game, This War of Mine, which is I first heard about in a talk at an event here, the Talk and Play event, which is kind of a games culture meetup here in Berlin. It's a very interesting meetup, actually. And this was about games used as memorials, and specifically to war. And This War of Mine, the computer game, was a game based on, well, it's non-specific, but it's kind of the survivors of the Balkan War. You play the survivors, and there was a board game version too. And the board game got labeled by many reviewers as more of a sort of art experience than a game. It's kind of a shared, somewhat depressing experience. But it's good. But is it a game? And especially with the board game, when you have cards, you have a board, you have dice, you have characters with statistics. Sounds a lot like a game. But a lot of people say, yeah, it felt more like a kind of intense experience, like watching a really good horror film. And when it's over, you're kind of relieved. But you had you had a time. I would say a good time, but you had a time. And I think some of these games that are mentioned in this article from the same creator as Depression Quest are sort of similar. You play them and you have an experience. Is it enjoyable? Is it horrific? Hard to say, but you have an experience. So if you've never heard of Twine or you're just interested in this kind of discussion, then go and have a read of that article. I actually intend to maybe go through some of the links that the article mentions and do some follow-up with what's happening with some of these projects, but haven't got around to that quite yet. But go and have a look if that sounds interesting to you. Next is an article from someone actually who I know from around Europe but is now living back in Berlin, an article on dev.2 from Christian Heilmann, who is the open web person at Microsoft and actually used to be a Mozilla before that. This is an article where he talks about kind of what's the title? The title is A Worrying Change in Open Source Perception. I guess his argument here from multiple facets is that open source used to be something that people do or did and do for a passion, to scratch an itch, to solve a problem, because they wanted to be open and collaborative. And now open source is sort of changing its proposition, especially in the eyes of business. And it's kind of becoming the things that a business have to do. And this is good in some ways, but it's also bad in some ways because it's putting a lot of pressure on maintainers of projects that are still kind of popular, but don't necessarily attract the big bucks, as it were. And he paralyzes, is that a word? Well, it is now. The stereotype of the developer in a startup, the 10x developer, the developer crushing it. And, you know, it's a horrible turn of phrase, which isn't so common in Europe, thankfully, but still with the actual reality, especially of an open source developer, usually working extra hours in their spare time, getting abused in GitHub and GitLab issues and pull requests, constantly being bombarded for feature requests from people who don't entirely appreciate the efforts going through. If you ever ask for money from a code fund or from Open Collective or something like that, people are very kind of snarky about it. You know, the actual reality of being an open source developer. And equally, as the open source contributor, I mean, one of the arguments is that sometimes these projects don't make it easy for people to get involved either. They equally get abused. They get phased by code style guidelines when they're just trying to correct a typo or CLAs from certain more commercial open source projects and things like this. And the whole process is still not really matching where it is now. There aren't necessarily any concrete conclusions, more propositions for conclusions in the article. Things like, and these are actually things that I propose in a different way because of the documentation work I do where you're frequently focusing on the onboarding for people using projects. I suppose things like considering that developer, that user / developer experience, things like making sure you keep on top of contributors' contributions because, and I know this, as I've sort of been scaling my own little business for a little while and you bring on people to help you, but that is actually a very hard time because you don't necessarily have any more time, but you know that empowering those people more to help you will free up your time. But at the same time, I'm using the word time a lot here, at the same time, finding the time to empower those people is also hard to find. And you get stuck in this kind of middle ground that's hard to get out of. And once you get out of it, it helps. But there's that initial steps. And I can understand why sometimes people get stuck with that. And then things like, online culture of contacting people and the way you speak to people, which is something I still see a lot. And some of this is cultural. Some of this is, I guess, in quotes, nerds and geeks not really understanding social boundaries and things like this. Anyway, it's an interesting post. There's a lot of comments in there as well. And actually, I think I might see if I get Christian on a future show. Seeing as he lives down the road, it would be appropriate. So go along and have a read. Finally, a post on Wired News of this week that was covered in many outlets from Katia Moskvich on Alexa being used by the NHS, the National Health Service of the UK, the Public Health Service of the United Kingdom. So the UK already has this kind of non-emergencies line, just to fill in some background, kind of started long since I lived in the country, but it exists. So this is to encourage people to not tie up emergency services with things like cold, flu, sprains, I guess, just to speak to someone, and sometimes recorded advice as well. to help solve these minor health issues. You don't really need to see a doctor or go to a hospital for and triage those. So I suppose the people in the NHS thought, well, you know, there's these devices a lot of people talk to. Why not offer that as a service too? It seems reasonable, but of course, well, Alexa is not directly run by the NHS. It's run by Amazon, and Alexa especially has a sketchy history with privacy. Every time there is an accusation of privacy violations, Amazon has a defense for it. I cast no judgment on whether this is true or not. I don't know. It's always hard to know because often it's these weird kind of anti-patterns with design. It's like, well, you can delete your data, but they don't necessarily go out of their way to make it obvious how is that necessarily any better than not allowing it at all. And of course, health data is something that is very private. You don't even, it's interesting because when we're sick, we're probably actually giving away data without even realizing. I have seen surveys in the past to show that Google, if you're using Google Maps and things like this, often knows you're sick before you do because it detects that you're moving slower, you're not as responsive as before, and things like this. It may be that you stay home more instead of going to work. So often these services, these data harvesting services, know you're sick even before you do. So is adding another outlet of that necessarily bad? Well, who knows? I mean, I suppose this opens the whole discussion that, again, people don't necessarily know these things, and it's good that they learn that these services probably know all this stuff anyway. Of course, Amazon is claiming that they're not keeping any of this data. It's going straight to the NHS. But is it? We don't know. What if in 6 months' time they reveal, oh, shit, sorry, everybody, we actually had this problem and we have been, et cetera, et cetera. So, yes, I'd be interested to see if, contrary to all the backlash against it, has anyone been using the service? I mean, the tech press, the privacy press is always going to call out things like this, but has anyone been using it? Has the general public thought, hey, this is a great idea. Sounds good to me. I don't care. Which would be interesting to know. And which the article doesn't cover, actually. So I'd be interested to hear from anybody who is in the UK that if you know if anyone's actually used the service. So, yeah, have a read. And if you know any more, then I'd love to hear from you. You can find contact details at kristenschiller.com/podcast. And now, as I mentioned earlier in the show, is my interview with Jean-Georges Perrin, serial entrepreneur, IBM champion, and now working on a new book with Manning Publishing about Apache Spark. And if the book sounds appealing to you, check the show notes because we have some discount codes for the book for you.
Thank you, Chris, for having me today on your podcast. So my name is Jean-Georges Perrin. I was born French, and I'm still French, and I moved to the U.S. a few years ago, and I do a lot of things. But one of the things that is of interest today is that I'm the author of Manning Spark in Action, Second Edition. Mm-hmm. I fell in love with Spark a few years ago, and I could not resist the urge of writing a book. And I'm not regretting it at all, but it's been an interesting experience. So.
I can imagine. I have written one book, not on a subject as complex. Well, I don't know. Maybe it was on web development, so I don't think it's quite as complex as Spark. Well, maybe, I don't know. Complex in a different way. But I'd just like to go back into your story a little bit.
Sure.
You actually have a Wikipedia page.
I had some friends who wanted to be nice to me, I guess.
I used to have one many years ago. I used to play in a band, and it's gone now. I need to get it back again. I need to somehow do something important to have a Wikipedia page again. Maybe at some point in the future. But anyway, as you said, you're originally from France, because I kept getting confused with the time zone, thinking you were in France. It says the Wikipedia page anyway – says that you're the only non-American IBM champion. What's an IBM champion?
Okay, so I was, it's probably out of date on the Wikipedia page. I'm not the only
at the time.
At that time I was the first. I think I was one of the first IBM champion in France, maybe other countries. I don't remember. But anyway, yeah. So an IBM champion is really someone who is an advocate for IBM. Mm-hmm. We are about 500 in the world mm-hmm. now. And it's really, you know, about recognizing what IBM has been doing. And really, because I'm a big fan of IBM. I know it probably sounds a little bit odd. I think it's a company that is probably a little bit underrated. Mm. Because their contribution, you know, it's funny. They contribute when we speak about Spark. We all know it's an open source project from in the Apache, backed by the Apache Foundation. But, you know, money doesn't grow on trees. Okay. So people have to be paid to contribute and to make it a successful product. And that's actually the business model behind a lot of the Apache, based product, Apache. So everybody that digs a little bit find out very quickly that one of the big company behind Spark is Databricks, most of the contributors.
It's the same as Cassandra, isn't it? I think from memory.
It's the same as, sorry, which one?
Is it the same company that also does a lot of work with Cassandra? I think Databricks.
No, Cassandra is Couchbase now. No, I don't remember. No, they don't do much.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, anyway, yeah. So I think Databricks. Well, if they do it, they do a lot with Spark, and they have another product now, which is called Delta Lake, which mm-hmm. is a mm-hmm. which is a in-memory database linked to Spark. But and they probably have other stuff. But anyway, so Databricks is a name that comes to mine very quickly, but IBM has been contributing a lot, and it's not really public. And I think a lot it's the announced figures, but I don't remember the figures, and I don't really want to remember. I don't. I've got limited memory blocks. So that's why. So I've been. Okay. An IBM champion for 11 years now.
And as far as I can tell, that's mostly with a product of theirs, Informix. Is that anything to do with Spark? Or I kind of operate in the very non-enterprise world, so I don't always know.
Okay. So I started my journey with IBM with Informix. So Informix, we need to rewind a little bit in the past. Informix was an awesome, and it's still an awesome database that came out in the 80s. And had some traction, had a very good market traction for a while. It was seriously competing with Oracle as a database. Now we don't know, nobody knows what Oracle is doing anymore. So they were in the mid 90s, typically they were competing with one another. Informix was one of the first database to introduce object storage back in the mid 90s. They had a first storage, distinguished storage, like having row devices and things like that. So it was pretty advanced in its time. I think it was also one of the first threaded database compared to a lot of them, which were kind of more monolithic database. And then in the mid 90s, that was one of the first scandal, like the Enron scandal, where the Informix CEO kind of cooked the numbers, and it actually all came from Germany.
Deutsche Bank is a perfect bank with a pristine reputation.
I've got a lot of German friends. I'm not. I still want them to be friends. But nevertheless, yes, Informix and Informix was still big in Germany, and is still big in Germany anyway. But they started cooking a bit of numbers, and that exploded in their face, and they lost a lot of traction because of that. And that's where Informix started to be a bit more in trouble as a company. And in 2001, what happened is that IBM bought Informix. So, and I was working since roughly 97 with Informix, so 4 years before the acquisition by IBM. And I thought it was great. If you project yourself back in the very early 2000, the panorama was much, much different. Okay. There was already open source and there was already things like MySQL, but the trust that people would put in open source product was not as great as it is now. And so commercial databases really were still very interesting. And IBM at that time was doing also a lot of groupware. And I really, you know, one of my very, very high expectation at that time was that Informix would become the brand, the database brand of IBM. Like when they bought Lotus, all their collaborative products, Domino and all the notes, and were under the umbrella called Lotus, so they kept the brand Lotus for a long time. So I was naive and hoping that Informix was that, but at that time the general manager who purchased Informix decided that it actually what they were mostly interested in is acquiring their user base and try to migrate the user base to DB2. And that didn't go very well. But so Informix had a pretty successful still in the IBM portfolio. And it's still in the IBM portfolio, but now, one thing I appreciate about IBM is that when they see that it's outside of the core business, they spin off or they license the technology or they find some kind of deals where people are taking over. And right now, so Informix is still an IBM product. It's still an IBM, intellectual property, but it's maintained and developed by a company called HCL. And they did the same thing with Rational and they did, and also groupware as well. So I like that IBM, you know, when you compare IBM to HP, for example, IBM, when they see that they want to continue something, instead of becoming even bigger than they are, they shift the products to other companies. And they did that for printers with Lexmark. They did that with PCs and x86 servers with Lenovo. So they're continuing doing that so they stay on their core business. That's kind of the integrity I like about IBM.
Okay. And just to wrap up the story, what took you to the States?
I've been an entrepreneur in my life quite a bit. I started my first ventures back in the mid-90s. In 2006, I created a company called Green Ivory. And we built a portfolio of e-marketing and web marketing tools. We got a lot of innovation and we were rewarded for this innovation. For example, we were doing sentiment analysis at scale back in 2011, 2012. And when I say at scale, it's really we were massively getting documents from the internet, measuring brand analysis and brand impact and sentiment and linked to those brands. So, that was at that time pretty early on the market. So we built this company and, unfortunately, we were not super successful in the market and, let's say that the French politics didn't help. So we had to terminate the company. And at that time I said, okay, well, I'm out of there. I'm out of France. If we were in a beer garden together, I could tell you a lot more about it. I'm not sure it's interesting the crowd, but anyway, I decided, pardon my French, but fuck it. And I went to the, I decided to go to move to the US.
But I think you gave me a good segue anyway, because, I'm guessing sentiment analysis is somewhat what brought you into what we would these days call big data and data analysis, which is sort of where Spark sits in many ways.
Yeah, so just
for those who don't know, what is Apache Spark? And I mean, typically Apache Spark often sits alongside some other Apache projects. So what's its purpose and where would you use it in your tool chain?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I can give you the answer, and I can cite the answer on the spark.apache.org website, or I can tell you what I think it is. And what I think it is I think it's an analytics and distributed operating system. Mm-hmm. Because it's really, you know, when you're building applications, you rely on your operating system. You add a layer, you've got some APIs and you build your application and you deliver your application. And that's great. When you're starting to do distributed computing, because the way to grow, right now is to do distributed computing. Mm-hmm. So you can't really, you can't just, you know, add more CPU to the same box. You've got to, the idea is to have more and more boxes to actually deliver more power. So that's what is distributed computing. It's not recent. Okay. Even in the 90s, I had a few distributed computing projects. So it's become more popular because of the growth of the data we had to process. So when you want to do applications like that and you want to leverage all those things, either you implement in your application all these libraries, all this knowledge of which nodes is available or which nodes are some resource available or whatever, and you've got to consolidate that in your application. And then you can actually start dispatching all your tasks. So, or you rely on something else to do that. And I think there's something else to do that is really Spark. And add on top of that a lot of ability to do analytics, all this aggregation, all this joining of your finding databases, all this function, all this extensibility you can build in. And that's why I think Spark is really this distributed analytics operating system where you can start building your application and deploying your application. And like for an operating system, when you build something, you don't really care about all the behavior of the system itself. So with Spark, it's a bit similar where, of course, you've got to care about the resource on your nodes and whatever, but you don't have to care that much. When I'm building an application, I don't care if a node is going to disappear. I don't care if my data is not available on one node, because all that is actually something that Spark will take care for me.
Okay. And I've come across Spark myself because I used to actually do some work with Apache Flink. I also work with a company at the moment that's kind of a partial rival to Kafka. So I know, and then there's also Hadoop, which I think from memory is still an Apache project. And I think there's a lot of these Apache projects all kind of cross over a little bit, don't they? Would you think they're complementary or they cross over or they're performing different parts of the same pipeline?
It's funny because I would say it's a bit of all of that. Okay. So for example, if you look at the very low level, you've got, big data brought a lot of constraints on a lot of things. So, if you remember when Cloudera and Hortonworks were two separate companies, they decided to have different file formats for big data. Because you couldn't do anything, all the things with JSON or XML or CSVs. So one was pushing Parquet and the other one was pushing, Oracle, and even MapR was kind of, not MapR, Confluent was pushing Avro. So you've got big data file format, but you've got this competition between the backers that are doing that. So there's always a little bit of competition. There's a bit of probably a little bit of waste. One of the thing I was I've been asked to do some kind of data prediction for 2019 for a company, and I said what was going to be interesting is which of Arc or Parquet is going to survive the merger with between Cloudera and Hortonworks, because I think there's no need for these two. They're pretty similar in a lot of ways. And they need to rationalize their offering. So there's all these things, but what I also like, so you could see a lot of competition with Spark, but also a lot of things where they can get along with others. First, when you look at Spark, it's more like an ecosystem, okay, as an operating system. It doesn't solve one thing. It can solve many things. And it can... The other aspect of that is it's a bit self-standing in a way that if you're trying to install Hadoop, it's going to be a pretty complex process. So you've got virtual machines and you've got a lot of, you cannot install really on your Mac, Hadoop just on a single node, where you can do a lot of things with Spark just on one single node. Okay. And out of the box, it supports SQL, which is not the case for Hadoop, for example. In many ways, people were also comparing, Spark as the evolution of Hadoop, and I kind of disagree a bit with that. It works fairly well in the overall Apache ecosystem. But not only. I mean, it became such attraction that if you want to, for example, plug it to Elasticsearch or Solr, it's very easy. Mm-hmm. And Elasticsearch, not Apache Foundation.
No.
I think that's where Spark has been smart in this way as well. Is okay, we're going to adopt this ecosystem and we're going to play nice in this ecosystem. And a lot of the things are pretty much interoperable. Mm-hmm. If you think about streaming, you can definitely do streaming with Spark. It has a lot of things, but the API is also can easily integrate with Kafka. Mm-hmm. So you don't need to use something else. You can just use Kafka because your infrastructure or your application developers are already using Kafka.
Just to help people understand the sort of specific tasks you might do with Spark. I mean, when I look at the Apache project page, it's kind of a bit of mixed messaging in my mind, maybe. Analytics engine, I sort of understand. And there's a lot of sort of phrasing that implies to do this fairly quickly on streaming data, as you say, i.e. data that's coming in all the time or large data set. But then there's a code example that's very, very simple. Like read a JSON file, show me... everything that's over the age of 21, which looks very simple, and I'm sure it's much more complex than that.
it's actually not.
Okay,
and that's really one of the thing is, it's not that complex. So yeah, and one thing, if we look at Spark. You've got this small example on their own page, yeah. And you've got something which they call the data frame, which is, if you do Python, or if the listeners know about Python, it's a very similar concept as the data frames in Python, but, it's an API under storage container. And really, if you learn the data frame API, which is not that complex, and this is where you see these things like data from .where and data from .select and data from .show. And once you've learned this thing, you can do SQL, you can do streaming, you can do machine learning. It's exactly the same API you will see across the different pillars that you will, where you'll be able to use Spark. So that's also a very powerful, tool for the developers. It's a very friendly developer tool, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so you decided to start writing this book for Manning.
Yep.
I would assume, but I might be wrong, that it's not the first book on Spark. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it is. But
no, you're not wrong at all. So you want me to give a hard time to my competition?
No. I'd like to know why you wanted to write it, what you felt was missing, what you felt needed to be explained differently.
Yeah. So first of all, Spark has been around for some time. Now I think something like, I think they celebrated that kind of 10th anniversary, okay, not too long ago, but really the early versions were not more like, more secretive than production. But, there was a major shift about 3 years ago when Spark went to version 1 to version 2. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the books, and still a lot of the books around, are still mainly around version 1 of Spark. And the consequence of that, even if they say they cover version 2, they cover version 2, but because of the compatibility, but not because of the concepts. For example, in version 1, Spark relied on a container, a storage container called RDDs, so for resilient distributed data sets, and which, as they say, they're resilient and they're distributed. But in version 2, that's where the community introduced this notion of data frame. And it's an abstraction on top of the RDD. And the big benefit of that is that because it abstracts the RDD, which are still there, they're not being replaced. But if you use the data frame, the optimizer called Catalyst can actually do a lot better work because it relies on this higher level interface, and the performance are much better. Usually when you add a higher level of APIs, you kind of lose performance. In this case, it's different. And so a lot of the books that are still out there are describing how to use RDDs, how to do manipulation at the lower level with RDDs, which I think is actually not that great. And when I'm doing consulting and I'm seeing a lot of people just doing RDDs, I'm saying, well, maybe you should consider, data frames. It's still useful to use RDDs in some very specific scenarios, but mostly it would be more interesting for people to use data frames for performance and ease of use and et cetera. So when you look at Spark in Action second edition, I mention RDDs because they are worth mentioning, because people need to know that they are here, but all the examples are using data frames. Okay. So I'm teaching in the book, I'm teaching data frames. So it's really, that's one of the angle that I wanted to take care, of in the book. So that's one reason. Another reason was that people thought that you needed to learn Scala to use Spark. Okay, so Spark is written in Scala, and they did a great job writing Spark. So I guess that Scala is perfect for writing Spark. But if you need to write applications that leverage Spark, well, you don't need to learn Scala. And a lot of books are on there. I have example in Scala. So if you're putting the bar saying, well, if you want to do Spark, you've got to first learn Scala, then you lose a lot of people. And all the examples in the books are written in Java, and the repo will contain Scala and Python examples, but it's really, for data engineers out there, which are probably more familiar with Java than they are with Scala. Mm-hmm. A third reason is similarly that a lot of people are also saying, you know, it's a kind of the myth to try to debunk that Spark is like the next version of Hadoop, which also implies that if you don't want to learn Spark, you've got to learn Hadoop. And I don't think I mentioned Hadoop that much in the book. Yes, because it's part of the ecosystem. Yes, because some of the components of Hadoop are interesting, like HDFS or Yarn as a Yarn is a resource allocator. So that's useful in the context of Spark. But it can be replaced. For example, HDFS is replaced by, in a lot of projects I worked with, it's either AWS S3 or IBM Cloud Object Storage. And as an orchestrator or as a resource allocator, Yarn is being replaced by Mesos or Kubernetes. So the lineage between Spark and Hadoop is not as strong as a lot of people would like it to make or appear. So that's also something I wanted to debunk in the book. And I would say finally, another reason is this whole operating system thing. That came from a talk I went to, at IBM, actually, yeah. IBM Think. That time it was called the World of Watson. And, on stage was a friend of mine, Rob Thomas, and, Rob was making a point about this analytics operating system. And I said, okay, well, I like you, Rob, but I figures I need to be convinced about that. So I looked into it and he managed to convince me. And I said, well, this is, you know, it's like an evangel. You've got, I feel like I've got to share this information with the rest of the world. And that's also one reason of the book. So that was all this motivation. Mm-hmm. And that's why also Rob wrote the foreword of the book, because I think he kind of deserved to contribute as well.
And this is the second edition. Yeah.
Yes, it is a second edition.
Did you write the first edition as well?
No, I did not write the first edition, and there's not that much lineage between the first and the second edition.
That was going to be because I the one of the books I wrote was also a second edition, and I must admit you end up rewriting way more than you think, just because it doesn't feel like you, you know.
Yeah, and you know the original title was not even Spark in Action. It was Spark with Java, and it started selling well as Manning does this Manning Early Access program. Mm-hmm. But we got some feedback from people saying, hey, maybe you should incorporate more stuff than just purely Java. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, well, I'm not going to put in documents the examples in the book, but we are going to have this more global view of the world. And therefore, Manning decided to call it Spark in Action Second Edition. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, well, you're in the book business. If you probably know what you're doing. So I'm not going to combat them. Mm-hmm. With you and actually I was kind of honored, because you know when you think about Manning's in action is kind of their, you know, premium brand, and that's what got them started. So I really said, okay, well, I love it, thanks.
And how did you go around structuring the book? It's always, I mean, I think with a tool like Spark, you know, you have this assumption that the vast majority of people who are going to use a tool like that have a vague idea of what they're doing, and have built fairly complex applications to know that they need a tool like Spark. So how do you decide where to begin and how far to take people on that kind of learning journey?
It was actually fairly simple. Yeah. When you're looking at a big data challenge, okay, you need to ingest data, you need to do some processing of the data, and you need to get the data out, okay? So there's this very fundamental process of ingestion, applying data quality rules, applying your transformation, and then outputting, I would say, the data. So I just follow that. I just follow this process. But so I divided the book in four parts. And actually, if I start by part two, it's the ingestion of the data, which in the process is really the most critical part, where you bring data in. Then the third part is about transforming your data and all the transformation you can do it. And the fourth part, which I'm kind of wrapping up those days, is about going further, which is actually exporting the data, understanding a little bit more. You can play in the ecosystem and such. But the first part is really to say, okay, well, we've got to make sure that you get the fundamentals of Spark and the fundamentals of big data. So it's that's why I call this part the theory crippled by awesome examples. I didn't want, you know, just to have a kind of a boring theoretical lecture, but really trying to learn key concepts about Spark, using examples. And I think, I got a lot of praise for this first part. So I guess that it's working. And I love to learn by example myself. And when I'm leading teams, that's also what I'm doing, is really trying to provide examples. And I think that's kind of a bit the lingua franca of a lot of developers. But writing a book, you've got to put the example in the context. You've got to put, you know, things around that to make it digestible and palatable. So that's how I structure the book. And really, I think it's going in every part, it's going from easier to a little bit more complex.
How did you decide what example to use? I think this is always a difficult thing, and especially with a tool like Spark, but like many, that is very, you know, you could do so many different things. How do you decide what example is the best demonstration of what's possible?
So I took a lot of time defining that, and it's true that when you're looking at things you find on the web, okay, because you find a lot of content on the web, but they always have this kind of dummy data sets that represent nothing. You know, like fields we've called ABC with value 1, 2, 3, whatever. Okay. We've all done this kind of lab stuff, but it doesn't teach you what happens when you've got a problems, or what happens with real data you've got to actually transform. So every time I had an example to write, I try to relate to something that is actually real life. What's on the top of my head right now is I just finished chapter 16, and chapter 16 it's about performance, caching, checkpointing, and explaining that. So what I've done is I took a data set from Brazil and the Brazil economics, the country, and I run a lot of different aggregation, a lot of different permutation of data to get some statistical information which is interesting about Brazil, like which is the biggest region, where's the most post offices, et cetera, et cetera. So by building this example around this data set, it gives more, you know, it gives more value, I would say, and to the people reading it, and also something which they can relate to. Okay. So people may not be familiar with Brazil, but you know that, okay, Sao Paulo is an economic powerhouse for the country. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to see how it ranks compared to the other states, et cetera. And you see that while reading reading the book. Okay, so that's a perfect way as you go to understand what caching does and what how caching works on your data, so it actually performs much faster when you use a cache at the right place. If I was using dummy data sets, it would be a lot more difficult to explain, well, this is where you need to put your cache, because it's just a dummy data, so nobody sees why it's there. Mm-hmm. Where when you're working on a real data set, I say, okay, well, I'm doing all this aggregation on the data. You can see the raw data at that point, but and after I apply data quality rules, then I've got a good data set at that point, and then I can cache it. Mm-hmm. And then I can do my analytics on top of it. Okay. So I think that's what I was trying to do. And it's a challenge. It's fun because I was trying to look at data sets. So I use a lot of open data around there. I try to use examples from around the world. I'm still European at art. It was actually fun to, it's actually very fun to look for the data sets. Chapter 17, which I'm working on right now, is going to work with a French data set. So people will have to learn French at the same time.
Well, that was going to be my next question is, where are you up to, so far? So chapter 17 out of roughly how many?
So I've wrote chapter 1 to 16, and the last one has not been edited yet, but it's in the expert hands of my editor. And if you're familiar with the Manning process, it's actually editors. Mm-hmm. I had a problem with 16, so in parallel I worked with 17. Mm-hmm. So 17 is in the works. And 18 is, I would say, halfway done. It's mm-hmm. usually I'm writing more linearly, mm-hmm. and 18 is the last one. But there was a lot of things that I wrote for chapter 6, which didn't make sense that early in the
yep.
book.
Yeah.
So I pushed them back to chapter 18. So I would say I have 1.5 chapter to write. My goal is to finish the manuscript by the end of this month, like really July. I've got a great editor, but she knows I'm never respecting my dates. So,
oh, I don't think anybody does.
I'll try for once to do it. But the idea is to finish the manuscript by, you know, really, really by the end of summer yeah. anyway.
Yeah.
I'm changing job at the very beginning of August. So
okay. You have to have it finished.
Yeah. So it's another motivation. That's a motivation.
Okay.
So it's mostly done, but as you know, after finishing the manuscript, there's a lot of work
yeah.
that has to be done still, like all the reviews, all the post editing, mm-hmm. and before it actually can go to print. I'd love to have it in print before Christmas, but I think I doubt that it will.
I'm not sure if it's a Christmas book anyway, so probably, yeah.
Come on, I want everybody to buy it for Christmas and put it under the Christmas tree.
Well, because of these days, probably ebooks, so I don't know.
And you know, the thing is, what I loved in the process was really, to be able to interact with the readers mm. as you write the book. So mm. some are awesome, and other ones you know you don't want to meet them in real life.
Mm.
And it's also trying to do a few things. For example, chapter 16, I decided to pick a data set from Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm going to work for a Brazilian company,
okay.
and the two first comments I got on the Manning catalog page was was, well, first I rated the book 5 out of 5. So thank you guys. But they are both comments are from Brazil. So to thank them, I wanted to use a Brazilian dataset. So.
Well, it works.
it's actually fun.
Yeah. And so for anyone who was interested in writing their own technical book, what would be like 3 pieces of essential advice you'd give someone? I mean, this isn't your first, you've done a few. So what would be some of the essential advice you'd give someone if they were writing their own technical book?
So, that's actually my third book. The 2 first books I've wrote were self-published. Mm-hmm. One was self-published when I was in college back in the early 90s. That was not even called self-publishing, I don't think, at that time. I don't know what it was called, like using a photocopier. But anyway, so writing with a publisher is tough.
Yeah.
If you think you can actually write by yourself and you can actually be self-published, and I've wrote a lot of articles as well, and I've wrote a few things also for IBM. It used to be called Developer Works, which is now it's called just IBM Developers, a developer program. Mm-hmm. It's you work with editors, but they do a lot of the job. Mm-hmm. They take your draft and they just make this awesome work of turning my Franglish into proper English. When you work with Manning, and I love my editor, she's great, but she doesn't do any of that. So she tells you things like, okay, it's not, you've got to correct that or that or that, but they don't hold your hand in a way. It's more like they're more directive. So when you're thinking about writing a book, you've got to take into account that it's going to take you a lot more time than you expect. And I think Manning knows that, because when I look at my contract and the date we originally put in my contract versus the dates, the actual dates, that's kind of completely, I mean, they were probably nice to leave them in the contract, but they were probably laughing at the same time. So it's really taking a lot of time. This whole project, for me started roughly 3 years ago, as the idea, and I've been writing with Manning since October of 2017. So that's going to be almost 2 years. It's also a big book. It's going to be like 600 pages.
Oh, wow. Okay. All right.
Okay. Yeah. There's 18 chapters. I don't know how many appendices. It's crazy. But there's a lot to know. And, but anyway, so Manning, has a lot of rules, which are good rules, okay? And you know, French people have a tendency to take rules as recommendations. But I think they are good rules, so they're good recommendations. And your progress, I don't know what your experience was, but I think that in teaching, in building teaching material and building the way I write, you get a lot better. At doing that, so I think it was overall a good experience. So in terms of advice, is really make sure you have the time and the bandwidth to do it. Really, family interaction takes a toll. I started by thinking that I could actually write a bit on weekends and combine all those things and it would be enough. And, this morning I get up at 4:30, and I usually get up at around 5:30. So I can actually write a couple of hours before I actually tackle my paying jobs. Because a book doesn't pay. So it's a lot of work. It's a lot of commitment, but it's also a fantastic experience. So it's really rewarding if you like this kind of reward. And if I've heard some people saying, everything has been written on everything already. So there's no room for me to write something. And I think that's wrong. I think it's, as you said, there's already quite a few books on Spark. But I think it's really about the way you teach people or you want to communicate your message. Mm. So if you feel strongly about something, well, put in writing. Okay. Write your book. Mm. And there's a market for it. I mean, there's an industry for it. It's not, the web has not killed books. So go for it.
Yeah.
Have fun.
And final question then would be, after all this, after all your practical experience, after writing a book, what would be, this might be a very hard question, I don't know, what would be the one or two, I don't know, whatever you think's needed, key piece of advice for someone wanting to get started with Spark? What's the, like, the one thing that people always seem to overlook that you really want people to know is...
Just buy my book. That was an easy answer. More seriously is be careful about this thing about that you've got to learn Scala or you've got to learn Hadoop before you start. So don't believe that. Get your own opinion. It's a great thing as well is you can work it on a simple machine. So don't think that you need to buy a huge computer, a huge cluster, to make it work or have some kind of subscription to some cloud services. So it works perfectly on your laptop. I think it's really easy when you get the concepts in and really the concepts are not that difficult if you're already familiar with relational databases, or even a SQL and some basic development skills. Mm-hmm. I don't think the bar to go to Spark is that high. In many ways, I think it's easier than many open source projects. If you want to go to Kubernetes, it's much more difficult, for example. I had a project.
Yeah. In Kubernetes.
The bar to get in is much higher. Spark is often, yeah. If you're, it depends where you come from, of course, but really, if you're familiar with RDBMSs, if you're familiar with some programming language, whether it's Java or Python or even Scala, it's fairly easy. So just go for it, work for it, and use some data sets. Try to it's easier, for example, if you want to try to, I'm not saying the book is mainly for data engineers, but if you're a data scientist or if you're an aspiring data scientist or if you're a data engineer that wants to do a bit more analytics, you go out there, you find a data set you want to exploit and you ingest it into Spark and then you start looking at the data that is being ingested and then you can start modifying, transforming the data, see what's coming out of it. And that would be, I think, the best way to get familiar with Spark and its output and what you can do with it. And I think it's a lot of fun as well. When I was writing the examples, trying to understand, what what you could do with the data, or what you could extract as insights from the data. I had to kind of calm myself down when I was just doing, you know, just simple ingestion, but I wanted to go further, like trying to do, okay, let's look at aggregations that you are joining the data. Oh, but that's, oh, we're only in chapter three. So maybe we should wait. But I think it's that thing. It's that kind of product where you kind of become passionate about it, mm-hmm. because you start with one angle and then you see where you can go and where you can add value and learn more. And then you become more curious. And then you go, you read more of the chapters of the book and the appendices and all those things. So it's really, I think that's probably where you should start is find your data set, go ingest it, start, you know, fingering with the data, and look at what's happening with it. So
cool.
So lots of fun.
I had a pun, which was it lit a spark, but yeah, we went. It was a very good. We'll just leave it there.
so if you when you get a chance to look at chapter 16, which is going to come, I think, really soon in the early access. I've heard that you were a fan of the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. So there's a reference to the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy in.
I think it's almost 16. Compulsory, isn't it? I don't know.
yeah. So
excellent. And so, if anyone is interested in finding more, then there I will. Well, you could search for the book on the Manning website. It's probably the easiest way just to find it. Spark in Action second edition. In the show notes, I will post some discount codes you can use. I won't read them all out because that'll be very tedious radio, but you can find them. And for more information on Jean, I have lost your website. There it is. For more information on Jean, it's actually a very simple website, jgp.net. You must have had that one for a long time. I don't know.
I've been having it for a long time. my first internet startup in the mid 90s was in the domain of internet. So I was sensitive to acquiring domain name early.
That was my interview with Jean-Georges Perrin, and about his book and his work. So as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, I have another little project to plug. This is something I've been working on and off for some time, and it's taken kind of different guises. This is my One Day the World Ended project. This started out as a series of short stories, which still exist. They're actually offline at the moment. I need to figure out what I'm going to do with them in the grand structure of the project, but they will come back along with re-released audio recordings of those short stories. The premise was the world ended, and quite how that happened is a little unclear. And then there's a series of scenarios, of kind of interweaving scenarios about what happened next. Somewhat surreal science fiction fantasy series of short stories. But I actually started creating a bot out of it as well to match my board game Jerkbot. Check that one out on Twitter if you don't know it. That sort of generated random tweets about how the world ended and what happened next. It isn't actually live yet because the grammar behind that is a bit more complex and nuanced than the board game Jerk one. But I also decided I'd turn it into a role-playing game after playing a game called Honey Heist on New Year's Eve, which was a very, very simple role-playing game. I suddenly realized that role-playing games don't have to be complicated. And I've played a lot of these kind of, you know, a couple of pages of rules type games, which focus more on storytelling. So I decided I would turn this idea into a role-playing game. The website is onedaytheworldended.com. You can find the rules there to play it yourself. And you basically have random characters and a random setting, and you have to kind of solve the mystery of what happened with your storyteller. The game also features an app which forced me to learn React, which I found interesting. It's probably an overuse of React. It probably didn't need anything so complicated, but it was a good excuse to learn it. And the app generates the characters for you with a bunch of characteristics and then the setting and the scenario. You could also find the game on itch.io, which is a website for people who self-make games. So if you're on there, you can also find One Day the World Ended on itch.io. I haven't really play tested this yet. It seemed so simple that maybe I didn't need to, but of course that's probably lazy of me. It's more that I just was enthusiastic just to get it out and maybe let people play test it itself. And as it's kind of lives online, I mean, I can update rules and tweaks as I go. So I'd love to have you and a group of friends play test the game for me, give me your experiences. I will be open source. Well, all the applications and code and the website are open source, but I need to add contributor instructions, et cetera, et cetera. Sorry, Christian, I will get there. And then I would like people to actually be able to contribute their own content to the generator that generates the world, their own scenarios. I have two scenarios in progress that I'm actually going to set up as well in case people find the random generator a bit too random. I'm creating a few scenarios as we go too. So I'm going to create a whole process where people can contribute to that. So if that sounds interesting, go to onedaytheworldended.com. And that's it for another weekly squeak. You can find more information on the show, previous episodes at christianjiller.com/podcast. And you can contact me at /contact. I'd love to hear from you. I also have a new Facebook page. I have migrated my personal profile into a Facebook page, facebook.com/christianjiller. It's a little empty right now because I've only just done that, but I will be putting a lot more interactions for the show up there too. And some other places are coming soon. So watch all of these spaces. But in the meantime, I'll stop blathering. And if you have been, thank you for listening.